Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the first episode in a long, long time for the Bone Collector. And I'm Patty. I collect bones. And for some of you, that's a pretty cool inside joke, and maybe we'll tell that someday. If you have any questions, you can go on to the chat on this website. Also, for those of you who are lucky enough to have my private number and you have a question, a comment, you can text me, and you can inbox me on Facebook and ask your questions as well. So how we usually do this, and you know, it's going to be the same as always, is we're going to talk about history, but dark history. We're going to talk about ghosts. We're going to talk about hauntings, murders, all of that that makes this world so interesting. And as always, we're going to start each episode with some neat little, used to be called paranormal news, but news is getting pretty scarce these days on the paranormal. So I'm just finding some cool little stories that might interest you, little tidbits of information. I have been known to be a person who knows a lot of worthless information. And a lot of my friends would have to agree. So I'm going to start off with Easter is coming up. It's going to be in a week, a little over a week and a half. And I know one of my favorite candies, and I'm sure that a lot of you share the love for Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. And we always hear stories on how these delectable chocolate treats are made just to see how delicious they can be. And they people building on their creativity. But the story about the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup has a little bit of a different background. H.B. Reese, who developed the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, had 16 children. You heard me right, 16 children. In the early 1900s, he was finding it very, very hard to provide enough money to care for his large family. So he went from job to job to job until he was finally hired with the Hershey Chocolate Company in Pennsylvania. And he learned all about the candy business from working there. And he decided that he didn't need to work for the Hershey Company anymore. He was going to start his own business and began testing his own recipes out. And his signature product was peanut butter cups. So that's how the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup came to be. And then Hershey's, full circle, it comes around and Hershey would ultimately buy Reese's company, which definitely would have provided enough money for him to take care of his family. So Reese's Peanut Butter Cups weren't made as an indulgence. They were made out of necessity to take care of a whole bunch of children that he had because, you know, couldn't control himself. I wonder what his wife looks like. I've got a picture of Mr. Reese. He's not bad looking. I wonder what his wife looks like to give him 16 children. All right, and another one of these stories, and I find this on, it's called Weird History is the name of the website. And I found this article that they had about a man that was simply known as Leatherman. No other name. Nobody knows who he was, where he was from. No information at all. But in the 1800s, Leatherman would walk in this 365-mile circle. No one knows why he did it, but he just walked continuously for 365 miles, and it took him 34 days to complete the circle. And he became such a regular with the different towns that he went through, that they could actually tell what time of day it was based on when he got in the town. So he got his name, as I'm trying to figure out why they would call him Leatherman. But apparently the suit that he wore, the clothes that he wore, were made out of old leather boots and ties. And it weighed more than 60 pounds. And he wore it all year round, no matter what the weather was, how hot it was, how cold it was. He wore that suit of leather boots. And he would sleep in caves. He would stop at houses. He didn't really speak to anybody. The few words that he said would be either in English or French. And he would go from the Hudson River, between the Hudson River and the Connecticut rivers. So walking through 40 small towns in a continuous loop. When he died, there were people that wanted to visit his grave so many times that they moved it farther than by the road because they put it pretty much where his body fell. And they thought it would cause a lot of accidents, so they moved it inland farther to keep people from getting hurt. And then they exhumed his body in 2011, and they thought that maybe they could do some DNA testing to maybe find out who he was. And when they opened his casket, his remains were missing. Leatherman was gone. Body was gone. Nobody has any idea who he is. But that is a cool story that I am definitely going to have to look into. And if you're interested in some of my upcoming books, I'm working on one that's called, they were called Home, and there's actually a chapter about bodies being snatched from the grave. And then our final little history that I've got here before we get on to our topic of murders that make you want to go, This goes back way back to the 1600s when Charles I was executed by a, they were called parliamentarians. And they didn't like how Charles I was ruling, so they had him beheaded. And to avenge his father's death, his son, Charles II, was king, and he decided to make a public spectacle of Oliver Cromwell, one of the gentlemen who spearheaded getting his father killed. And he wanted to kill him in the same way that he had killed his father publicly with a beheading. Would have worked to punish Oliver Cromwell, except he'd already been dead. So Charles II was bent on making a example of Cromwell and what was going to happen if you messed with his family and the crown. So they had his body exhumed, and then they beheaded. What made matters worse is so that people would be reminded of what was going to happen to them. For 25 years, his head was put on a stake outside of Westminster Hall, and it stayed there for 25 years as a reminder that if you kill a king, you're going to be beheaded. And it stayed there until a storm blew it off its stake, and it began a journey that lasted about 300 years, where his skull went from collector to collector for scientific testing to all sorts of other ridiculous reasons that his head was passed around. It's still on display. I believe it's on display in Museum
However, if you want to learn more about it,
everybody has a Wikipedia page these days. If you have any kind of notoriety, just to let you know, Oliver Cromwell's head, yes, just his head, has its very own Wikipedia page. So like I tell my children when they're doing their research papers, don't always rely on Wikipedia, but you might find some humor out of following the travels of Oliver Cromwell's head. All right, to our topic tonight, and I was trying to figure out, you know, what I wanted to talk about for my first episode back after a year and a half. So I thought a little bit on, you know, some of these stories that had been presented to me. The three stories that I'm going to talk about tonight, I did not find on my own. They were actually given to me and asked to research and to find out if I could figure out what actually happened in each of these instances. Now, the first one I'm going to talk about is Jenny Perrin. And I want to say about 3-4 years ago would be one of her nieces contacted me via email and said, I would like you to look into the death of my aunt. I don't believe that the cause of death that they said was actually what happened to her. So I said, sure, I'll look into your aunt's death. And she sent me a series of newspaper articles from the local Rochester paper. In fact, this girl lived on Culver Avenue, which is now Culver Road out in on the east side of the city. So pre-August 1910, Jenny Perrin, age 19, was in a relationship with an older man named Bert Thompson, who was a former National Guardsman. And at the time, Bert was married to his second wife, and Jenny was his mistress, and she stayed that way until her death. All fine and good. Men back then had mistresses all the time. They had a wife, they had their mistress, took care of business. So Jenny threw a little bit of a wrench into his plans and got pregnant. And he thought he was keeping this affair pretty secret for the time being. But once that baby came, there was going to be some problems. So he had to figure out a way to take care of this. He had to figure out a way to take care of this is kind of my conclusion. Around 8 p.m., one night, I believe it was in August. Of course, I don't put all my dates down. But you know what? Dates really aren't that important, especially when you're telling a story. So around 8 p.m., Jenny left her house and she told her father she was going to go downtown. Downtown could have been anywhere. Nobody knew exactly what she meant. But okay, Jenny was 19. Come and go as she pleased. And she left, and about an hour later, she came home and went to her room to lie down, which, you know, anybody that's been pregnant knows that later in the evening, 9-10 o'clock at night, and you're pregnant, you're a little bit tired. So she went to her room and she lied down. And soon after she went to lie down, she began to scream and moan and writhe in pain. And her father rushed into the room, and between the screams of pain and the twisting and contorting of her body, he was able to discern that
that Bert had taken her to Pearl's doctor on Child Street, where she was given some medicine, which she took. And then he asked her who was responsible for her current condition, and her response was Bert Thompson and no one else. So as the story goes along, a doctor was called to parents' home, and before he could get there, Jenny died, and most importantly, she died before she could tell anybody who the doctor was that she went to see. Now, Jenny Parent passed away on January 21st, 1911, and like most stories of adultery, when one of the parties is taken out of the picture, it's easy to deny being involved with or even knowing the deceased because there isn't anyone that can corroborate the story. So Bert denied that he knew Jenny. However, that was a lie that was to be exposed because during the coroner's inquest, evidence was presented that contradicted Bert's testimony. A postcard had been sent to Jenny while he was stationed in Farnham, Maine, as well as a photo being found in her trunk of Bert. And the explanation given by Bert was that the discovery was that she must have stolen these items from an acquaintance. Pretty convenient, if you ask me. And apparently, Bert was romantic with more than one Jenny because he said he knew a Jenny, but it wasn't Jenny Parent. And as for knowing her, Jenny's parents and even Bert admitted to having been a visitor at parents' home on several occasions. So there went with the whole story that he said that he didn't even know her because he backtracked from that. And the determination from the autopsy was that Jenny died from, according to her death certificate, convulsions and pus in the kidneys, which was another name for a renal abscess, with her pregnancy being a contributing factor. Furthermore, Bert claimed that he had an alibi for the night of Jenny's death. He said he wasn't with her, and in fact, he hadn't spoken to her for 8 months. And then he said he was at a wrestling match at the Armory, but no one could corroborate his attendance because he knew no one there. So was he really at the Armory, or did he carry out a sinister plot to rid him of Jenny and all the problems that this baby would have for him? And as for the mysterious doctor that Jenny said that she had saw, what kind of medicine would be given to her, and how could it have caused her convulsions? So I did a little bit of research on this, as the lady had asked me to do. And I found out that at the time, I mean, this information is readily available through old city directories, that there was no doctor on Child Street. No doctor that she could have visited. Another article said on Dewey Avenue. There was no doctor on Dewey Avenue as well. So, there was no doctor on Dewey Avenue as well. So there wouldn't have been a doctor for her to visit. Also, I looked into what the kidney condition that the death certificate said that she had, which was pus in the kidneys, so it would be a renal abscess. And I looked to see what was involved in that, and convulsions aren't a symptom of renal abscess. Pain is, but not a convulsion. Fred? I have a sneaky Pete. He snuck back in the office after he wanted out. Anyways, so what could have caused her death? Well, I'm going to say that it was most likely a poison that she was given. And I'm going to say that it was most likely arsenic. However, that was something that was never tested for during autopsies. And like a lot of different poisons and different ways of committing murder, we can do exhumations, and we can now do forensic testing
on the bodies to figure out even 75, 80, 90 years after the murders, up in
some cases more than 100 years after the murder, we can tell what the poison might be. However, arsenic has to have a very specialized test, and it has to be specifically asked for, and after a certain time, it's not detectable. But I do believe 100% in my heart that Bert did indeed murder Jenny to get her and this baby out of the picture so that he can continue having affairs behind his second wife's back and, just live the life that he wants without any consequences. From what I can find out, the coroner's inquest, the jury that was there, agreed with Bert and that he did not cause the death of Jenny. I don't believe that. There's too many what ifs, too many what about that. So I'm going to have to say that I truly believe that Bert Thompson got away with the murder of Jenny Perrin. So then the next story that I have, the next murder, kind of interesting. And for all of you who know anything about firearms, this one is a good one. And this one, when I worked at Wegmans, our Wegmans had a bunch of officers from the local police department that were stationed there to make sure that we weren't robbed blind. And I got to talking with people that know me know that I talk to anybody about anything. I'm a talker, and I was talking to one of the officers from the local police department, and he said, "We can't look into this, but perhaps you could, because we do not believe that this officer from our department passed away in the manner in which they say he did." I'm like, sure, no problem. And he said that the officer's name was Constable Dick. And I'm like, okay, which I thought was kind of funny. Franklin C. Dick. And he was a law enforcement officer in the 1930s. All right. For the town of Gates. And this happened in 1932. November 14th, 1932. And they say that he was shot in the line of duty. Really? Okay.
Didn't know that Gates was the Wild Wild West back in the 1930s, but I wanted to see what they questioned about Constable Dick's, I'm kind of people texting me and commenting on the show. For some reason, the chat doesn't work. So, like I said, you can comment on Facebook, you can inbox me, you can text me if you have any questions. So anyway, back to Officer Franklin G. Dix. He died in the line of duty, and apparently he is the only law enforcement officer in the town of Gates to die in the line of duty. I'm like, okay, he was shot in the line of duty. That should be pretty cut and dry. What kind of question would you have as to why he, why they would just disagree with that? Now, in the board meetings, there was a matter of protection by the constable, and they discussed that primarily due to the amount of cash held by the town clerk that she received from residents who came to her home and paid taxes. So they were trying to figure out what they were going to do to protect the town clerk with all the money that she was collecting for taxes and stuff. I guess back in 1932, taxes were pretty high then, just as they are now. Nothing changes in the government, but we're going to let that pass. And while they were discussing this, Officer Dix was killed. Now they say, and I'm trying to figure this out, especially since I've seen drawings and demonstrations as to where he was killed, but it says that Officer Dix bent over, and in the process of bending over, his service firearm fell from his pocket and discharged. At which time, a bullet entered his abdomen, and the next day, he died at the hospital. All right. So he was accidentally shot. Service firearm fell out of his pocket, discharged, and shot him in the abdomen. However, where this gets a little sticky is that the bullet that went into his abdomen entered through his back. So I'm trying to figure out, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody that has firearm experience, he bent over, his 32 caliber automatic pistol, it says in the newspaper article, fell to the floor and went off. And the bullet entered his lower back, passed through his body, and lodged just under the skin of his abdomen, where they removed it. And apparently it didn't hit any vital organs or anything like that. But how, this is, how can you possibly, if you're bending over and your gun balls out of your pocket, wouldn't it fall onto the ground kind of in front of you? A, first of all, why was your firearm in your pocket and not in a holster? But wouldn't you bend over, your firearm falls out of your pocket, wouldn't it fall in front of you? It most definitely, if you're bent over and your firearm goes off, and you're in a bending over position, so your lower back is up, pointing towards the ceiling, how do you shoot yourself in the back?
that's where my question lies. So anyways, they cut the bullet out and they said that he was in good condition when he got to the hospital, but he took a sudden turn for the worst and he died the next morning. So any of this information, having any kind of anything that you want, is supposed to be available through a FOIA request. Now, I've done a FOIA request both on Jenny Perrin to get the autopsy reports from her death, and it's understandable that they said that there is no no record. They didn't keep any records back that far in that kind of situation with the coroner's inquest, which is much different than just a coroner doing the autopsy and you going to appear before a jury of your peers, as is now. But when I did a FOIA request for Constable Dix, the response that I got was there were no official police reports for the incident, which I thought was kind of shocking that a officer shot in the line of duty, accidental or not, that there would be no police report at all. And there was also no autopsy record or coroner's report for the death of Officer Dix, which I thought was also very strange. But what they did give me in my FOIA request was a packet of documents that ended up just being a copy of the newspaper article that tells about the incident and it also had just some historian, it's like ancestry type information, talking about him and mostly about his family and things like that. So that I'm not, look, I'm not.
All right. So we are going to do this show
through my phone. And we're going to see how this works.
I am
calling in as a guest. Okay. I figure out how to get rid of these. All right. So what we're going to talk about now is Harrison. Officer Harrison was a state trooper. I got to turn this down. I got some major feedback here. We'll figure out what's going on with this. Yep. How's this now? Is it better? We're working on it. Okay. Are we still got feedback? No, it's not. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hang up, and we're going to talk about the last story. I'm going to call back in, so don't go anywhere.